Duke was not as other men, and could have wished, after all, that she had let Lizzie come along.
"A little caviar," he offered.
She enjoyed caviar, which she preferred to eat with a soup spoon, and judged it best to fortify herself against whatever might happen next. While she tucked in, the Grand Duke said,
"You shall have music with your supper. You must know I am a great collector of all kinds of objets d'art and marvels. Of all things I love best toys, marvelous and unnatural artifacts."
He winked at her in a manner that she found lewd and offensive. It occurred to her, "Does he believe the Colonel's story? Does he think I'm really made of rubber? If so, where does he imagine the caviar is going to?" He pressed a button at the side of the stove, and a section of the bookcase with which the walls were lined flew up. The gilded leather spines were only so much painted trompe l'oeil all the time. A musical trio, all together on a round-wheeled podium, rolled forward out of the dark cavity within the wall. The wall fell back into place with a soft thud. These musicians were almost full-grown, about the size of Sicilian puppets, only a little less large than we are, and constructed of precious metals, semi-precious stones, and the plumage of birds, which last made Feathers shudder, as a cowboy does when he sees a blonde scalp on an Indian's belt. And indeed, one was in the very shape of a bird, of a thrush or a nightingale, but a very big bird, and the skilled artisan who made it had given it a Joseph's coat of feathers of all kinds of soft, dark, whiny, topazy colours, and sharp little eyes of red gemstones. It stood on two sturdy legs, scaled in overlapping shingles of beaten gold. Instead of a beak, it bore a flute, an intricately carved flute of ivory. There was a stringed instrument, too, a harp or a lyre in the form of a hollow woman, or rather, a woman with no torso, for there was a head and shoulders and breasts, and there was a pelvis, but there was nothing in between the breasts and the pelvis except a set of strings attached to pegs on either side. She had arms, too, arms extended in a supplicatory gesture that had come about quite accidentally, for they were stuck where they were when the mechanism that operated her last wound down. Her arms terminated in beautiful, cunningly articulated hands, with fingers and fingernails, all complete. And she was made of gold, with mother-of-pearl for the fingernails, and a mass of hair made of golden wires, and eyes of lapis lazuli on white enamel. At the impulse of a random current of air, she emitted a single, ghostly twang of her own accord. The percussion section was the least unnerving. It was just a bronze gong, set in an ebony frame, but there was no sign of a gong stick. The Grand Duke surveyed his clockwork orchestra with a satisfied air. A bored emperor commissioned them long ago in China. A mandarin murdered the emperor to obtain them. A bored ancestor of the Grand Duke's murdered the mandarin to get them for himself. They had the authentically priceless glamour of objects intended only for pleasure, the impure allure of the absolutely functionless. The Grand Duke pressed another button. The gong agitated itself and gave out a sweet thunder. The golden shoulder of the female harp moved, and in moving, set in motion a complex hidden mechanism of wheels and pulleys that drew up her elbows and brought the hands against the heart strings. Her golden fingers, her pearly fingernails, flexed and stretched. She plucked a chord from herself, while the big bird whistled down its nose a strange, tritonic, almost melody, that meandered through its mathematical possibilities in a time that did not seem to be that of this planet, but of some remote and freezing elsewhere. Feathers thought, "There's a musical box inside the bird," and "Anyone who could make a grandfather clock could put that harpy together," and "The gong is sounded by electrical impulses." All the same, the hairs on her nape rose, and the Grand Duke turned to her a satisfied smile, as if all along he intended her to be afraid of him. For the first time in her life, She refused champagne.
Adding another percussive note to the uncanny harmonies, a drip fell from the nose of the ice feathers and struck the glass rim of the caviar dish with a plink. For an aghast moment, she thought a diamond had melted. The Grand Duke gave her his arm.
"Come to the gallery and inspect the rest of my collection."
His breath, fiery with vodka, singed her cheek, that moment by moment grew more chilly, as the weird geometry of the haunting, circular, not quite random, fully inhuman music deformed the angles of the room. The gallery was lined with glass cases, lit up in such an ingeniously subdued way that each one glowed like a distinct little world.
"My eggs," said the Grand Duke, "are full of surprises."
"I bet," thought Feathers.
Yet each glass case contained an egg, truly an egg. A wonderful egg that never came from a chicken, but out of a jeweler's shop. And he told her she could have whichever egg she chose just as soon as she took off her shawl and let him see her wings.
"Egg first.
After."
"No."
"Yes."
"No."
The Grand Duke shrugged and turned his back on her. All at once, every light in the place went out, leaving her in the dark, with only the hooting, plucking and rattling of the artificial musicians down below for company, and the faint plash as the ice dripped off her own effigy down below. When she heard her nose melt, she felt faint.
"Very well," she said sulkily.
When the lights came on, her shawl was off, and the Grand Duke went behind her to take a good look at the twin swellings in her bodice.
"But you can't touch," she said.
Even in this extremity, some steely edge in her fishwife's voice made him keep his hands to himself. What inward things his eggs were, and indeed full of surprises. For this one is made up of pink enamel, and opens up lengthwise to reveal an inner carapace of mother-of-pearl, which in turn opens to reveal a spherical yolk of hollow gold. Inside the yolk, a golden hen. Inside the hen, a golden egg. Now we have diminished to the scale of Lilliput, but we have not done yet. Inside the egg there is the tiniest of picture frames, set with minute brilliance. And what should the frame contain but a miniature of the Aerialiste herself, in full spread, as on the trapeze, and yellow of hair, blue of eye, as in life. In spite of the increasing sense of diminishment she felt, and the odd shapes the music made of the corners of the room, Feathers was flattered by this tiny tribute, and her crude sense of justice told her it was only fair to give the Grand Duke permission to run his hands over her breasts and round beneath her armpits. After he had ascertained she was not made of rubber, he sighed, perhaps with pleasure, and started to agitate the plumage rustling under the red satin. Squeak, twang, bang, and splash from below. Squeak, twang, bang, and splash. A simple egg of jade sat in a gem-encrusted egg cup in the next case, as if waiting for a spoon to tap it. Feathers gazed expectantly at the Grand Duke, eager as a child, in spite of her apprehension. She guessed there was more to the egg than that. He left off his fumbling for a moment.
"Let me turn the little key."
Noticing how his virile member now briskly outlined itself under the whipcord of his riding breeches, she bethought herself that in some respect he must be the same as other men, and gave it a brisk conciliatory pat, as if telling it to bide its time. The eggshell fell apart in two hollow halves, revealing a little tree in a tub of white agate, overlaid with gold trellis work. The tree was covered with leaves individually carved from dark green semi-precious stones. Its golden boughs were studded with flowers made out of pearls, split four ways round a diamond centre, and fruits made of citrine. The Duke reluctantly released his right hand from its business under her shoulder blades and touched one of these fruits. It too split open, and out flew the smallest of all possible birds, made of red gold. It moved its head from side to side, flapped its wings and opened its beak, and a shrill, sweet warbling came out.
"Only a bird in a gilded cage."
Feathers gave a start.
It finished the chorus, folded its wings, and the hollow jade closed over again.
For all the delight she felt to see this beautiful toy, Feathers found this tree and its bird exceedingly troubling, and turned away from it with a sense of imminent and deadly danger.
"Whir," she said to herself again.
Squeak, twang, bang, and splash. Squeak, twang, bang, and splash. And she felt more and more vague, less and less her own mistress.
Walter would have recognized the sensation which gripped her. He had felt much the same in her dressing room at the Alhambra, when midnight struck the third time.
"I may be getting out of my depth," she thought.
"Oh, Lizzie, Lizzie, my darling, where are you now that I need you?"
All the same, since fair is fair, and he deserved something for going to so much trouble, she reached round behind her and unfastened the hooks and eyes at the back of her dress. There was a swishing rush of released plumage, and the Grand Duke exclaimed softly under his breath. Nuzzling away, he begged her to spread a little more, and she did, whilst, although he did not ask her to, a deep instinct of self-preservation made her let his rooster out of the hen coop for him and ruffle up its feathers as he was ruffling hers. Yet it was then, as her eyes went round the shadowy two-tiered room, that she saw there were no windows anywhere, and when the Grand Duke's arms tightened around her, she realized he was a man of quite exceptional physical strength, sufficient to pin even her to the ground. Then, the worst she could at that moment imagine, happened. His investigation of her torso flushed out Nelson's sword from its hiding place in her corset.
"Give me that back!"
But he held the lethal toy out of her reach, examining it curiously, chuckling under his moustache, before he bent his knee to snap the sword in two across it. He sent the pieces flying to either end of the gallery where they disappeared in the darkness that was seeping in through the walls like water. Now she was defenseless. She could have wept. Down below, the mechanical musicians continued to play, and the ice continued to melt. She gathered together her scattered wits as well as she could, and moved resolutely on to the next case, continuing to manipulate him as she did so, as if her life depended on it. He dragged his feet, growing so blissful he scarcely noticed her open the case with her free hand. And here, inside a silver egg crisscrossed by a lattice of amethyst chips, she found, to her incredulous delight, nothing less than a model train, an engine in black enamel, and one, two, three, four first-class carriages in tortoiseshell and ebony, all coiled round one another like a snake, with engraved on the side of each in Cyrillic the legend, "The Trans-Siberian Express."
"I'll have that one,"
she cried, reaching in greedily. Her exclamation and sudden movement roused the Grand Duke from the trance she had induced, although she never stopped caressing him. She'd not served her apprenticeship at Mar Nelson's Academy for nothing.
"No, no, no,"
he forbade her, although his voice was glutinous with tumescence. He weakly slapped the hand that held the train, but she did not let go.
"Not that one. The next one's for you. I ordered it especially. They delivered it this morning."
It was white gold, and topped with a lovely little swan, a tribute perhaps to her putative paternity. And as she suspected, it contained a cage, made out of gold wires with, inside, a little perch of rubies and of sapphires and of diamonds, the good old red, white and blue. The cage was empty. No bird stood on that perch yet. Feathers did not shrink, but was at once aware of the hideous possibility she might do so. She said goodbye to the diamond necklace down below, and contemplated life as a toy. With oriental inscrutability, the automatic orchestra laid down the geometries of the implausible, and by the thickening of his member, the movements that now came of their own accord, by his panting breath and glazed eye, Fevers judged the Grand Duke's time was nigh. Then came a wet crash and clatter as the ice carving of herself collapsed into the remains of the caviar in the room below, casting the necklace which had tempted her amongst the dirty supper things. The bitter knowledge she'd been fooled spurred Fevers into action. She dropped the toy train on the Isfahan runner. Mercifully, it landed on its wheels. As, with a grunt and whistle of expelled breath, the Grand Duke ejaculated. In those few seconds of his lapse of consciousness, Fevers ran helter-skelter down the platform, opened the door of the first-class compartment, and clambered aboard.
"Look what a mess he's made of your dress, the pig!"
said Lizzie. The weeping girl threw herself into the woman's arms. It was the dark abyss of the night, into which moon plunges. In this abyss, she had lost her magic sword. The station master blew his whistle and waved the flag. The train slowly, slowly began to pull its great length out of the station, dragging with it its freight of dreams.
"I've learned my lesson," said Fevers,
and sitting up, ripped off her bracelet and earrings. There was a sudden flurry and a burst of outraged boyish protest in the corridor. The door of their stateroom burst open, and in came Walser, clutching in his arms a kicking, vehemently protesting little bundle, dressed up in a clown's clothing.
"Sorry to disturb you, ma'am," he said to Fevers, "but this young gazoony ain't gonna run away with a circus, not for a few years yet."
The train slid slowly past a platform, thickly piled with freshly fallen snow. Lizzie let down the window, letting in a gust of cold air, and Walser dropped the howling child outside, inside a snowdrift.
"Now pick yourself up and run straight home to Granny. And give her these," cried Fevers.
Little Ivan rolled in the snow, pelted with diamonds. "Through our children, we might be saved, perhaps." The train picked up a little speed. Walser hung out of the stateroom window until he was quite sure that little Ivan had not jumped back on board further down the train, then hauled the window up again on its thick leather strap. When all was secure, he turned back to the occupants of the carriage, and was struck dumb to see Fevers, raddled with tears, hair coming down again, gypsy dress ripped and clotted with semen, trying as best she could to cover her bare breasts with a filthy but incontrovertible tangle of pin feathers. Part 3. Siberia. Chapter 1.
How do they live here? How do they cope with it? Or aren't I the right one to pop the question? I'm basically out of sympathy with landscape. I get the shivers on Hampton Bloody Heath. As soon as I'm out of sight of the abodes of humanity, my heart gives way beneath me like rotten floorboards. My courage fails. Now, parks I love. And gardens, and small fields with hedges and ditches round them and useful cows in them. But if you must have a wild hillside, let there be at least a sheep or two posed picturesquely on an outcrop of rock, ready to have its wool wound off or something like that. I hate to be where the hand of man has badly wrought. And here, we are on that broad forehead of the world that had the mark of Cain branded on it when the world began, just as the old man at the station who came selling us the bears he'd carved had convict branded on his cheek. I bought all the bears he had to send home to the children when we reached Vladivostok and a post office. He couldn't call it a cheap gesture. He charged enough for the things, I'm sorry to say. And I got an earful along with it, for Lizzie swore I did it for posterity, meaning for the young American to take note of. Since he has made himself known to us in Petersburg, you've been acting more and more like yourself, she says. Outside the window, there slides past that unimaginable and deserted vastness, where night is coming on, the sun declining in ghastly blood-streaked splendour like a public execution across it would seem half a continent, where live only bears and shooting stars and the wolves who lap congealing ice from waters that hold within it the entire sky, all white with snow, as if under dust sheets, as if laid away eternally as soon as brought back from the shop, never to be used or touched. Horrors! And as on a cyclorama, this unnatural spectacle rolls past at 20-odd miles an hour in a tidy frame of lace curtains, only a little the worse for soot and drapes of a heavy velvet of dark, dusty blue. The rasp of charcoal in the corridor means they're stoking up the samovar for tea. How cosy we are. Brass monkey weather outside, but in our carriage, snug and warm. There's a little stove. And a round table with velvet cover, blue to match the curtains, and an easy chair upholstered likewise, in which our Lizzie sits, dealing out a game of patience for herself. Patience. Give me patience.
What I mean is, you grow more and more like your own publicity, says Lizzie. Ever the golden-hearted cockney who don't stand on ceremony.
Well, who am I supposed to be like then, if not myself? I snap bad-temperedly, lying on my belly like Miss O'Malley as needs must on the seat they make up into my bed at night.
That's another question, innit?
She replies, unperturbed as ever.
You never existed before. There's nobody to say what you should do or how to do it. You are year one. You haven't had any history and there are no expectations of you, except the ones you yourself create. But when you come a cropper, God, you really come a cropper, didn't you? You flirt with the adversary, as if he'll put by his wiles if you pretend to be an ordinary girl. I'm afraid for you. That's why I don't like leaving you alone. Remember that bloody Grand Duke? Broke your mascot you set such store by, didn't he?
She knows how to hurt. Find the sore point, then probe it. That's Liz's style.
Broke your mascot and could have broken you. He nearly did for you once and for all. And then no future, no year two, nor any more years. Nix, naught, nothing.
Nothing. The train now ground to a halt with an exhausted sigh. The engine wailed softly, the locking wheels clicked and groaned, but nothing in sight. Not even one of those frilly little wooden stations like gingerbread houses they put up in these parts, mocking the wilderness with their suggestion of the fairy tale. Nothing but streaks of snow standing out unnaturally white against the purple horizon. Miles away. We are in the middle of nowhere. Nowhere. One of those words like nothing that opens itself inside you like a void. And were we not progressing through the vastness of nothing to get to the extremities of nowhere? Sometimes the lengths to which I'll go for money appall me. In the sudden, almost supernatural silence, we could hear the rumble of a tiger's roar and the ting-a-ling of the chains of the elephants, which never ceases. Tuskers through Siberia! The hubris of the little fat colonel. Often the train made these incomprehensible halts. Out of the tiger, like imps conjured from air, children would spring up and run along the side of the track holding out little offerings. A baked potato, a paper cone of frostbitten berries, sour milk in a bottle too precious to be sold, so you fill up your own cut glass water flask with its contents. But by tonight, we've rolled far too far away from any peasant homestead or settlement. The tow-headed, filthy hawkers never venture here, where wild things are. A cold wind began to get up a bit, and whine. I say, old Liz, can't we hurry things up a bit? Lizzie, at her cards, shook her old grizzled head. No tricks? Why not? For the things my foster mother can pull off when she sets her mind to it, you'd not believe. Shrinkings and swellings and clocks running ahead or behind you like frisky dogs. But there's a logic to it. Some logic of scale and dimension that won't be meddled with, which she alone keeps the key of, like she keeps the key of Nelson's timepiece, stowed away in her handbag and won't let me touch. A household magic, she calls it. What would you think when you saw the bread rise if you didn't know what yeast was? Think old Liz was a witch, wouldn't you? And then again, consider matches. Lucifers, the little wooden soldiers of the Angel of Light with whom you'd think she was in complicity if you'd never heard of phosphorus. And when I think I once sucked milk from those flat old dry old dugs under your black silk bodice, Lizzie, oh yes. I know what you mean by magic. Now, down the train in the wagon salon, There's the princess, trying out the parlour organ there. Grunt, grunt, grunt. Oh, such ecstasies of boredom I experienced on the Great Siberian Railway. Not that the wagon salon isn't very pleasant, if it don't give you the willies to travel through this wilderness as of the pre-Adamark world in a repro empire drawing room done up in white lacquer and enough plate glass mirrors for a mobile bordello. I hate it. We've no right to be here in all this gemütlich comfort, stuck on our fat bums down this straight track from which we never deviate, like tightrope walkers in a dream traversing an unacknowledged abyss in five-star comfort through the deep core of winter and this inimical terrain.
Feel like a bird in a gilded cage, dear?
Inquired Lizzie, noting her foster daughter's fidgeting.
And how would you prefer to travel?
Feathers, thus pushed, could think of no reply.
The springs twanged beneath her as she rearranged herself in order to squat on her haunches with her sulky chin on her knees and her muscular hands clenched round her femurs.
How long have we been grinding through limbo? 1 week? 2 weeks? A month? A year?
The princess at last had her way with a parlour organ and produced from it a Bach fugue that hushed the tigers while the world tilted away from the sun towards night, winter, and the new century.
Think of your bank account, dearie,
Lizzie ironically advised her sullen foster child.
You know, it always cheers you up.
Feathers, in her petticoat, stockingless, corsetless, dug in Lizzie's handbag for a pair of little scissors and began to clip her toenails for want of anything better to do. She presented a squalid spectacle, a dark half-inch at the roots of her uncombed hair which tangled with a dishevelled plumage that had already assumed a dusty look. Confinement did not suit her. Then, as she clipped away at her toenails just as the train had stopped for no reason, so for no reason, she began to grizzle.
How can I tell why I began to blubber away like that? Who hasn't cried since Ma Nelson died? But to think of Ma Nelson's funeral only made me bellow more, as if the enormous anguish that I felt, this anguish of the solitude of our abandoned state in this world that is perfectly sufficient to itself without us, as if my sudden and irrational despair hooked itself onto irrational grief and clung there for dear life.
"Cry away,"
said Lizzie, and by the echoes in her voice, her foster daughter knew a prescient fit had seized her.
"Cry all you like. We don't know if you'll get enough time to cry later on."
Inexplicably, as it had halted, the train now moved off again. In the hard class, the clowns played cards under a mauve canopy of cigarette smoke, or slept. A heavy somnolence was upon them. They seemed in a state of suspended animation, here and yet not here. Now and then, one or other of them would remark they'd have to work out a whole set of new routines now that Buffo was gone.
"Time enough for that," came the reply.
Yet the days passed, and they did no more than shuffle and reshuffle the cards. The rocking horse rhythm of the train lulled them into a state of passive acquiescence in which they waited, though none would admit it, for their Christ to rise again. So there was no need of new routines, no need.
Pass the bottle, deal out the pack again. He will come back, or else we shall return to him.
The Colonel, however, trotted up and down the corridors, a bubble with the excitement of the Pathfinder, a striking figure in his striped leotards and starry vest.
"Showing the flag," he called it.
He'd brought ample supplies of bourbon with him, and soon taught the steward in the restaurant car to fix a passable julep, using sprigs from a pot of mint he'd had the forethought to pick up from a Petersburg horticulturalist. He soon acquired the reputation of a character. He and his pig often rode in the cabin with the engineer. The engineer leant back with the papyrus glued to his nether lip and let the colonel frolic at the controls. But most of all, the colonel enjoyed visiting the elephants, feeding them buns he bought by the hamperful from kerchiefed peasant women at the wayside halts, and contemplating the dazzling occurrence that he, this good old boy from Kentucky, had bested Hannibal, the Carthaginian, classical hero of antiquity,
for if Hannibal had taken his jumbos over the Alps, had he not himself taken his bulls over the Urals? Yet even to his always optimistic eye, it was apparent the bulls were taking the trip badly. They were housed comfortably enough, lapped in straw in a cattle truck that usually took immigrants across the steppes, and, a special measure for the pachyderm's comfort, this truck had been equipped with a stove. But the elephants no longer resembled the pillars of the world, capable of supporting the sky on their broad foreheads. Their little eyes were filled with rheum, and sometimes they coughed. The train took them further and further into bitter weather that would penetrate their leather boots and freeze their feet, invade and devastate their lungs. Far north, much further north, in the extreme, unimaginable north, of which this terrain was the, comparatively speaking, temperate margin, their cousins, the mammoths, lay locked in ice. So it seemed that ice was already overcoming these caryatids of the world, and the colonel, for all the Pollyanna in his soul, was yet seized by isolated and wounding moments of doubt when he saw the bulls were weakening, succumbing. Then he would urge the conductor to feed more charcoal to the stove. Surely they suffered just a chill. And as to their depression, why, a few buns would cheer them up. He bit down upon his doubts as upon an aching tooth, and refused to believe his eyes. These days, the tigers watched the princess in the same way their little cousins, who live amongst us, watch a bird in a tree too high to climb. The princess petitioned the colonel via the medium of Mignon, who now spoke for her, and was roughly translated by Feathers, to let her commandeer the wagon salon, and the colonel, after much cigar mastication, permitted her to do so on the advice of Sybil, who thought a change of scene would distract them all. None of the conductors dared enter the wagon salon thereafter, but the tigers appreciated their new quarters in their own way. They ripped open the pale brocade with which the armchairs were upholstered, made nests of the stuffing, and cuffed at their reflections in the mirrors that took up their stripes and multiplied them while Mignon leant against the princess's shoulder, and they tried out a whole new repertoire to suit the organ, sentimental parlour songs, Bach chorales, the Methodist hymn book, anything that might calm the tiger's spirits. But the princess knew the cats no longer trusted her, and worst of all, nor did she trust them. She was consumed with guilt and despair because she had used her gun. The colonel did not like to hear the parlour organ, since when he thought of the corpse of the tigress, the fatal last night at Petersburg came back to him in a fugue of failure. Indeed, his constant excitement had something febrile and desperate about it, for the apes had left him in the lurch. His master clown had somersaulted out of the ring into the madhouse. The princess's loss wasn't the half of it. And in his heart, although his head hotly denied it, he knew the elephants grew each day more feeble. It was a singularly depleted grand circus he would present before the god emperor of Japan, unless he could acquire on the way a performing bear or two, perhaps. Siberia could afford no other kind of recruit. He knew full well that those who play the ludic game sometimes win, but sometimes lose.
Oh, those humiliating headlines and variety!
His heart missed a beat when Mignon sang, "Oh, sacred head, sore wounded," and he imagined his own scrubby pate buffeted by fortune. Outside the wagon salon, the strong man stood with folded arms. He was the watchdog. If Samson's heart still knocked in his chest like a bird in a box when he saw the frail shape of Mignon, he'd learned to subdue himself sufficiently to fetch and carry humbly for the girls, to muck out for them, assist them with all the tasks to which his muscles condemned him. Unrequited love was performing a peculiar alchemy within the strong man, and yet the object of his love was changing its nature. Stark lust for lost Mignon slowly resolved itself, out of sheer propinquity, into an awed veneration for these beings who seemed as a pair to transcend their individualities. He knew he could not love the one without the other,
as he could not love the singer without her song, and must love both without touching either. So by degrees, he grew less physical. He'd taken to wearing clothes, a visible sign of his changing sense of himself, had bought himself a stout belted Russian shirt, and in it looked already less of a hulk. He nourished his sensibility, which was still at the stripling stage, by standing guard over them. He let the colonel pass, with a curt nod. The colonel counted his blessings over fish soup in the dining car. Thank God! He retained exclusive use of the Cockney Venus. The mellow pink shade of the table lamp soothed the hysterical brilliance of the ruse with which she had concealed the traces of her fit of tears. Although, of course, it was too much to contemplate tonight, she had made a token effort to dress up to first-class standards, put on a tea-gown of cream lace, and pinned up her hair so that you did not notice her dark parting. But the tea-gown, cut to drape over her bosom, was unbecoming, giving her a middle-aged, thickening look, and her pinned-up curls were drooping already. The lucky violets, bravely pinned on her shoulder, were unconvincing imitations, cheap, tatty things, a child's birthday present, perhaps. The waiter watched with fascination as the colonel tied a napkin around Sybil's neck.
"Pigs eat everything a man eats," he informed the table. "That's why a man tastes same as a pig. That's why cannibals call roasted Homo sapiens long pig. Yes, sir, omnivores, see? Mixed feeding gives us both that gamey taste."
As if the notion of cannibalism refreshed his appetite, he attacked a veal cutlet with gusto. Although, by its texture, the cutlet had been cooked in the station buffet at Irkutsk several days before, loaded on the train, and reheated in a gravy far too bright a brown for authenticity. "As for me, I slipped the nasty thing on my own plate across to Sybil, who speedily dispatched it just as the colonel said she would. I'd a great affection for the clever little pig, I must say, and she did look well on travel, far better than I did. Her ruff was as pristine as the day we left Petersburg, more so. Who did the colonel get to go for it for him? The girl who looked after the samovar? The steward? And she shone with the oilings the colonel was never too far gone in his cups to give her, and I thought, I could do with a massage myself, if it was young Jack me lad give it to me. Here he comes. What is it this young man reminds me of? A piece of music composed for one instrument and played on another. An oil sketch for a great canvas. Oh, yes, he's unfinished, just as Lizzie says. But all the same, his sunburned bones, his sun-bleached hair, underneath his make-up, that face, like a beloved face known long ago and lost and now returned, although I never knew him before, although he is a stranger. Still, that face, which I have always loved before I ever saw it, so that to see him is to remember, although I do not know who it is, I then remember. Except it might be the vague, imaginary face of desire. Absent-mindedly, she bit into a chunk of bread that had the colour and texture of devil's food cake. As the colonel took Sybil on his lap to make hospitable room for Walser, the young man felt the hungry eyes upon him, and it seemed to him her teeth closed on his flesh with a most voluptuous lack of harm. All she had done was to define the necessary innocence of the adventurer, and to take advantage of it. Spoon chinked upon soup plate, knife ground against cutlet. The fringed pink lamps swayed this way and that, reflected in the dark windows, as if they might be blooms upon the branches of the enfilades of trees through which they now were passing. The waiters rolled suavely to and fro, as if on invisible wheels, with dishes lined along their arms. From the invisible kitchen came the clatter of pans. There was a Macedonia of fruit for dessert. Then, just as the princess and Mignon arrived in the restaurant car in bloody aprons, Samson dogging their footsteps, on the way to the kitchen to collect the tiger's dinners, there came a thunderous boom. And, as if at the command of the biggest drum roll in the entire history of the circus, the dining car rose up in the air. For a split second, everything levitated. Lamps, tables, tablecloths. The waiters rose, and the plates rose from their arms. Sybil was lifted up, as was the chunk of canned pineapple, on which her jaws were just about to close. The feet of the dark girl and the fair girl in the doorway were propelled upwards from the rising floor. Then, before shock or consternation could cross their faces, the whole lot fell down again, and with a rending crash, flew apart in a multitude of fragments. The train immediately ceased to be a train, and turned into so many splinters of wood, so much twisted metal, so many screams and cries, while the forest, on either side of the devastated track, burst aflame, ignited by the burning logs cast far and wide from the firebox of the now demolished engine. The giantess found herself trapped under the collapsed table at which she'd been engaged in picking pale maraschino cherries from her Macedonia and spooning them into the dish of the pet pig. Her first emotions were surprise and indignation. Nearby in the dark, her foster mother expostulated eloquently in her native dialect, but none of Lizzie's tricks could get them out of this hole. Only the strength of the mussel's feathers now stretched to their fullest extent would shift the wreckage and let them and their bruises scramble out into the open air, which in itself was hazardous, filled with flame and flying debris. The wind, now risen to a gale, scorched them.
"I have broken my right wing. As the first shock passes, I feel the pain. It hurts. Hurts as much as a clean fracture in the forearm. But no more. A lot to be thankful for. I can still keep the use of my right arm, even though the wing is broken. God, it hurts. Could be worse. Keep the stiff upper lip, girl. Keep on telling yourself how it could be worse. Indeed, it seems all we in the restaurant car were fortunate. His minion surfaced, having sustained a black eye from the blow of a flying brandy bottle, but otherwise unhurt. She's dragging the princess out from under a cascade of crockery and silverware that has cut and scratched and concussed her. Lizzie gives a quick check. No bones broken. But she can't wake up the princess, who has passed out. As for the colonel, it must be he who's made of India rubber, not I, for here he comes bouncing out of the rubble with his pig safe in the bosom of his jacket. Did Sybil foresee this fix, for all her talent as a seer? Did she, hell? Her ruff is a casualty, though, flat as a pancake. The colonel strips her off. From now on, this little pig will go naked. My young man? No sign. Then, amongst the ruins of the wagon salon, I beheld a great wonder, for the tigers were all gone into the mirrors. How to describe it? The wagon salon lay on its side, ripped open like the wrappings of a Christmas toy by an impatient child, and of those lovely creatures, not a trace of blood or sinew, nothing. Only pile upon pile of broken shards of mirror that segmented the blazing night around us in a thousand jagged dissociations. So you might think, if you had time or patience to fit them back together then, suddenly all would be as it had been before. The forest, the plain, the twin tracks of the railway lines bearing forwards towards the infinity of the horizon, the pretty little carriages and the puffing train, which now seemed to me to have been a kind of gauntlet flung down in the face of nature. A grand gesture of defiance, which nature had picked up, then tossed disdainfully back upon the heaving earth, shattering it into fragments. And as for the tigers, as if nature disapproved of them for their unnatural dancing, they had frozen into their own reflections and been shattered too when the mirrors broke. As if that burning energy you glimpsed between the bars of their pelts had convulsed in a great response to the energy released in fire around us, and in exploding, they scattered their appearances upon that glass in which they had been breeding sterile reduplications. On one broken fragment of mirror, a paw with the claws out. On another, a snarl. When I picked up a section of flank, the glass burned my fingers, and I dropped it.
Mignon was cuddling the princess in her arms. Now and then, tiger fashion herself, she licked the forehead next to her shoulder. But what shall the tamer do when the beasts are gone? Or Orpheus without his lute, for that matter. For I could not guess where her own piano might have got to, and the parlour organ from the wagon salon lay higgledy-piggledy in bits on the melting snow, a random collection of pipes, as if there had been a cataclysm in a plumber's. It was a frosty night, yet the snow melted in the heat. Up above, you never saw such stars. And of my clown, no trace. But the rest of Clown Alley began to heave and bubble up from the smithereens of the hard class, wiping the rubble out of its eyes. Accustomed as they were to catastrophe, it was no more to them than any other incendiary vehicle, I dare say, and their dogs shook themselves and ran around and snapped and whined and got under everybody's feet. And still I couldn't find him. Retain the use of my hands as I may, I'm in some discomfort. Imagine you've got an extra arm, hinged on at the back, and it's dangling down, it's broken. I got down on my knees in the dining car, excavating a cache of veal cutlets that had broken out of the icebox and were littering up the place where my bewildered eyes thought they'd glimpsed a movement. And the conductors and the engineers and every single one of the waiters, all in one piece, more or less, or so it seemed, came to jostle me and impede my search as they quested for the train supply of vodka. But of the young fellow who was my quest, not so much as a great toe or a little finger I could keep in a locket as a souvenir. Then a soft, moist, questing thing attacked me in the back of the neck, causing me to jump. It was, for God's sake, the tip of the trunk of an elephant. For poor things, it turns out this very moment should be the fated moment, a moment of destiny, when indeed their chains all parted and they were free. Yet free for what? They achieved their long-fought liberty at just the moment when it won't do them any good. They'd smashed their way easily out of the remains of their confinement, and formed up in a line good as gold. Some passed bits of wreckage along to one another while others filled their trunks with melted snow and squirted upon the fires in an attempt to put them out. All this as though they'd never heard tell of pneumonia. The Jumbos were a lesson to us all, and had we the chance to join them in their sterling work, no doubt we'd have left the wreck neat as a new pin by morning. But we were forced to leave them to it because, while I was digging away for some relic of the young American, all we survivors of Colonel Carney's circus were kidnapped. Every one. Liz said it was though our abductors materialised out of a copse of birches like guardian spirits of the woods. A band of rough-looking coves in sheepskins, armed to their teeth. Evidently they lacked ponies or draft beasts, for one or two of these men were dragging odd contraptions behind them. Long poles of larchwood with leather strips criss-crossing them. The kind of cart you might invent if you hadn't thought of the wheel. They'd come, as if prepared to ferry away the injured, although only the princess lies in need of a stretcher. They barked out a few orders of which my friends understood not one word, being reluctant linguists. But the language of the gun is picked up very quickly, and our captors soon nudge them into a column with their rifle butts. But I've no proper recollection of all this. I only know what Liz told me, that I am screeching like one possessed as I scratch and scrabble in the wreckage and push them pettishly away when they come prodding me with their guns, at which I'm picked up bodily and dropped on my face in one of the carts. Lizzie thinks to throw over me a blanket which she salvaged, as I am too far gone to think of covering myself up. So off we go at gunpoint, and the rest of the survivors, well, they don't give a monkey's. They've just found the liquor cupboard, and don't so much as turn their heads to look, though Liz says, I'm making an awful racket. But I remember nothing. They say the angel Tubule watches over small birds, but I'm a little on the large side for such protection. Big birds must look after themselves. So I'd better snap out of it sharpish, hadn't I?
Chapter 2 Walser was buried alive in a profound sleep. Knocked out by a blow on the head when a cupboard door in the bulkhead above him flew open, he immediately submerged beneath an avalanche of stowed-away tablecloths and napkins, some clean, some soiled. The busy elephants piled various other items from the demolished dining car, cruets, corkscrews, boxes of biscuits, on top of the soft tomb in which his adventures would have ended, except, after a lapse of time and consciousness, a murderess came and dug him up. Chapter 3. Although no signpost points the way there, and even the track, made by the shackled feet of its inhabitants in the course of the dolorous journey to the place, is soon obscured by the rapid summer growth of mosses and small plants, or erased by winter's snow, so that no trace remains of their arrivals, we are in the vicinity of the settlement of R, near which, in the year 18, the Countess P, having successfully poisoned her husband over a period of years with an arsenical compound and got away with it, and finding herself in her widowhood, much possessed by the idea that other women had committed the same crime as she with less success, set up, with the permission of the government, a private asylum for female criminals of the same stripe as herself. Do not run away with the idea it was a sense of sisterhood that moved her. If, though the years passed, she herself never forgot the precise nature of the seasoning she'd added to her late husband's borscht and piroshkis, she assuaged the conscience that pricked her by becoming, or so she claimed, a kind of conduit for the means of the repentance of the other murderesses. With the aid of a French criminologist who dabbled in phrenology, she selected from the prisons of the great Russian cities women who had been found guilty of killing their husbands and whose bumps indicated the possibility of salvation. She established a community on the most scientific lines available, and had the female convicts build it for themselves out of the same kind of logic that persuaded the Mexican federales to have those they were about to shoot dig their own graves. It was a panopticon she forced them to build, a hollow circle of cells shaped like a doughnut, the inward-facing wall of which was composed of grids of steel, and in the middle of the roofed central courtyard there was a round room surrounded by windows. In that room, she'd sit all day and stare and stare and stare at her murderesses, and they, in turn, sat all day and stared at her. There are many reasons, most of them good ones, why a woman should want to murder her husband. Homicide might be the only way for her to preserve a shred of dignity at a time, in a place, where women were deemed chattels, or, in the famous analogy of Tolstoy, like wine bottles that might conveniently be smashed when their contents were consumed. No reasonable female would hold it against their Countess P that she poisoned her obese, oafish count, although the blend of boredom and avarice that prompted her to do so was in itself the product of privilege. She suffered sufficient leisure to be bored. Her husband's wealth provoked her greed. But as for Olga Alexandrovna, who took a hatchet to the drunken carpenter who hit her around once too often, Olga Alexandrovna acted out of a conviction that his eye was on the sparrow, and therefore on even such a weak, timorous, and unworthy creature as herself, so that the life being beaten out of her was surely worth as much, in the general scheme of things, as the life of the man with the fists. Perhaps, since she was a loving mother, more. But it turned out the court thought otherwise than she, and so for a time she suffered atrocious pangs to find the court believed she was a wicked woman.
"You're in luck,"
the turnkey told the convicted woman, after the French phrenologist measured her head and asked the court that she should be transferred to the Countess's scientific establishment for the study of female criminals. Good luck indeed. No hard labour, no flogging for Olga Alexandrovna, bound as she was for the Countess's seminary. And the turnkey laughed, raped her, and chained her. Next day she set out for Siberia. During the hours of darkness, the cells were lit up like so many small theatres, in which each actor sat by herself in the trap of her visibility, in those cells shaped like servings of baba au rhum. The Countess, in the observatory,
sat in a swivelling chair whose speed she could regulate at will. Round and round she went, sometimes at a great rate, sometimes slowly. Raking with her ice-blue eyes, she was of Prussian extraction, the tear of unfortunate women surrounding her. She varied her speed so that the inmates were never able to guess beforehand at just what moment they would come under her surveillance. As for the inmates, indeed they toiled not, neither did they spin, just as Olga Alexandrovna's turnkey had foretold. Not even the lash disturbed the even tenor of their days. They were fed morning and evening. The food, black bread, millet porridge, broth, was delivered through a grill, and it was certainly as good, if not better, than Olga Alexandrovna was accustomed to. A bucket of water arrived in the mornings, when the previous day's toilet pail was taken away, and a fresh one delivered. The bedding was changed once a month. No mail was permitted, and the isolation of the place itself, far off in the taiga, would alone have precluded the possibility of visitors, even if they had not been strictly forbidden. By the standards of the time and place, the Countess conducted her regime along humanitarian, if autocratic, lines. Her private prison, with its unorthodox selectivity, was not primarily intended as the domain of punishment, but in the purest sense, a penitentiary. It was a machine designed to promote penitence. For the Countess P., who conceived the idea of a therapy of meditation. The women in the bare cells, in which was neither privacy nor distraction, cells formulated on the principle of those in a nunnery, where all was visible to the eye of God, would live alone, with a memory of their crime, until they acknowledged not their guilt, most of them had done that already, but their responsibility. And she was sure that with responsibility would come remorse. Then she would let them go, for by their salvation, strenuously achieved through meditation on the crime they had committed, they would have procured hers. But so far, the gate had never opened to allow one single departure. You could think of this wheel-shaped house of correction as a kind of prayer wheel, intended to rescue the Countess, who was its hub, from perdition, although the only thing in it which rotated like a wheel was herself on her revolving chair. Olga Alexandrovna was no great reader, although, unlike many of her neighbours, she knew her letters well enough, hard and pointless as the task of learning them had seemed when imposed on her in her childhood. All the same, she'd have liked the scriptures with her, to help her out in some of the ethical discussions she conducted with herself, but books were forbidden, because they helped time pass. So she sat and pondered, inside the house of correction, in which there was no hint of the wide world outside, for there were no windows to let in daylight, ventilation being provided by a system of ducts. Above the arched gateway that let in a glimpse of daylight only when it opened to admit another inmate, there was a clock that told the Moscow time that was not the time of these latitudes, and this clock regulated their risings, their feedings, registered every slow minute of incarceration, and sometimes the face of this clock seemed indistinguishable from the livid face of the Countess. The Countess intended to look at them until they repented. But sometimes the women died, it would seem, for no reason, or as if life, in that perverse honeycomb, was such a faint and faded thing that anything would be an improvement. When one died, a guard humped the corpse out of the cell and buried it under the paving stones of the circular passage in which they took their morning exercise. Even death was no escape from the house of correction. As soon as the cell was empty, another murderess was delivered up to the gate, which closed upon her with a definitive clang. So the ordeal of penitence began, an ordeal constructed from a perfected variety of the bitterest loneliness, for you were never alone here, where her gaze was continually upon you, and yet you were always alone. But so far, although the Countess lived in hope, not a single one of the objects of her gaze had shown the slightest quiver of remorse. By the end of the third year of her incarceration, Olga Alexandrovna would never have said she was innocent,
She'd always admitted her crime freely, but every day she offered extenuating circumstances to the lenient and merciful judge in her mind, and every day they made more and more impression on the judge. Each night, before she